Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now, I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. It's my great pleasure today to be talking with Charlie Stewart. Charlie is a member of the participant panel at Genomics England since 2016. And is one of our first panel members here. He's also a patient advocacy and engagement lead at Congenica at the Wellcome Genome Campus, and has also done other work on genomics and epilepsy there. Charlie is passionate about and active in raising money for epilepsy, for cerebral palsy, and for rare disease charities. Charlie, it's a great honour to have you on the pod, and thanks for making the time.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you for inviting me to chat with you.
No, it's great. There are so many angles that I would love to talk to you about, because you are both a genomic scientist in your own right, and also a parent and carer for children with rare diseases and conditions. I'd love to start, if we can, with your sort of intellectual and academic journey in genomics. And if we can cast the clock back to maybe even secondary school, you know, how did you get into this field? When was the first time you heard the word genomics, or the, I don't know if DNA is a word, the letters DNA? How did you get into this field?
Well, science, I studied sciences at A level, so I had a particular interest in biology. And then I started at the Wellcome Genome Campus in January 1994, actually. And I did my degree sort of through the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute paid for me to do a degree via day release. So I did that over sort of 5 years, and so I've worked on the human genome since 1994. I also did my PhD through the Sanger Institute, looking at genes involved with type 1 diabetes, and specifically looking at genes on human chromosome 10. So I've been very privileged to have followed the journey of the Human Genome Project from start to, I wouldn't say finished because it's a long way from being finished, but you know, it's a usable resource.
Yeah, that's great. And how did you decide to do sciences at A level? Was it just you were good at them, or was there a passion there, or how did you decide to get into it?
I always enjoyed it. Even at GCSE level, I enjoyed science. Maybe that's just my curious mind. I don't like to be told what's real. I like to look for it myself. So
fantastic. And did you have any sort of "Oh, Captain, my Captain" type inspiring teachers along the way?
Probably not.
So you're a ferocious autodidact.
We had really good teachers at school, but for me, my inspiration was through the people I've worked with at Sanger. So I worked very closely with Sir John Sulston on the Worm Project, which is the Worm Genome, which is what he championed. And he actually used to help me with my homework.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, he used to stay late with me. And it was very embarrassing. I had to ask him about serial dilutions, about what does 1 in 10 mean? And he sat down and he drew it out for me. And he was a wonderful man. And he was a real champion of helping people out and spreading the word about genomics. So
what you've just said reminds me of a really basic point about genomics, is that it's not just humans that have genomes, right? You've mentioned the Worm Project and so on. And this is maybe a slightly side topic, but the Sanger Center at Wellcome is doing a huge project on animal genomes as well, right? The human genome fits into that wider picture. Tell us about that. Have you gone from worms to other animals along the way?
Well, the worm genome was really sort of the forerunner to the Human Genome Project. The C. elegans worm, I think it's got around 1,000 cells in it. And Sir John Sulston actually got a Nobel Award for his work with the worm genome, where he, and so the worm is actually, the C. elegans worm is see-through. So he was able to sit there and draw every single cell under a microscope as it developed from the sort of a single cell up to sort of a thousand. And it's got a genome of around 100 megabases, which is massively smaller than the human genome. But of course, at the time, it was a proof of concept, really. And of course, the C. elegans worm, it's not massively different genome-wise. It has a mouth, and it has an anus, and it has a stomach and a brain. So it actually shares, you know, from a long way back, you know, a number of genes with the human genome. So once we had proved we could do that, we were able to ramp up those technologies for the sequencing of the human genome.
And today we almost take for granted the ability to use these fantastic machines from Illumina, from BGI, from ONT, from PacBio, whoever, to do this. Paint a picture for us in 1994. What did it look like to start sequencing the human genome? What did you do when you get up in the morning?
Well, so I would spend my first few hours of the day cutting the lids off these little test tubes, because we only had those ones with lids on. I don't think they little tubes without the lids had been produced, and certainly we didn't have them back in 1994. And once I cut the lids off about 48 of these samples, I would then do a DNA prep, which would you'd take a colony of DNA which had got the sequence you wanted to look at. I'd pick it with a little toothpick and stick it into some agar, and then we would grow it up. And that would be 48 samples I would do in my first few weeks. And you would manage to, when that was then sequenced and put onto a, loaded into a gel plate, you'd have maybe sort of 36 different channels, or so to speak, that you would load your samples into. That would take a few hours, and then you would run it through the computers, and you might get sort of 300 base pairs from one sample. So you can imagine that was unbelievably laborious. That technology, you'd never have got, well, it would have taken, I don't know how many years it would have taken to do the human genome that way. But then, of course, things changed pretty quickly. I think once we knew we were going to ramp up doing the human genome, and then we had the capillary machine. So instead of running down an agar, they would sort of be whizzed up into these little capillaries, and you could then sequence many more samples in one go, and also much more quickly. And then, of course, Illumina, or Celexa, that was the company originally before, out of Cambridge, I believe. Of course, it introduced this sort of massively parallel sequencing technologies, which, game changer.
And the rest was history, as you say, right? The sort of next generation sequencing. I'm kind of having a mental image of moving from stop motion animation to something like Toy Story, I guess, that craft.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really was just astonishing, the difference. Yeah, it was incredible.
So you're working on the human genome, and where have you taken your work since then? You've worked on various pieces and are now at Congenica.
I was at Sanger for 22 and a half years. I was working on the human genome, and I was actually involved with identifying whereabouts the genes are in the human genome, and then sort of drawing out their structure, which is then used in genome analysis, including by Genomics England, through a project called Ensemble. While I was working on the human genome, we were also working on these model organisms, such as mouse and wallaby and platypus. I worked on this.
You headed down under.
Which is, I mean, extraordinary. You know, I guess privileged to work on, you know, to look at their sort of bits of their genome. But it wasn't until, it was just after my daughter was born, when she was born prematurely and spent a month on intensive care, and after about 6 months, we noticed that she'd her development had stopped, actually gone backwards, and she stopped doing things like laughing and taking interest in her surroundings. And then she developed these really weird sort of jackknife movements from time to time. There'd be sort of clusters of them over a period of a few minutes. So we videoed her and then took her to accident and emergency at Addenbrooke's Cambridge University Hospital, where she was diagnosed with a catastrophic form of epilepsy called West syndrome. And interestingly, West syndrome is, it's not massively dissimilar to the epilepsy that sadly David Cameron's son had, He had something called Ohtahara syndrome, and he also had cerebral palsy. In fact, some children who have Ohtahara syndrome go on to develop West syndrome. So, you know, that there is some sort of relationship there. Anyway, that was, you know, that was obviously a huge shock, because we were told that, you know, this is a potentially fatal form of epilepsy and you have to stop the seizures, otherwise the child keeps on regressing. And, you know, if you can't stop those seizures, well, you know, then sometimes the very worst happens. So there was one thing I could do, really, which to sort of get a little bit of power back over our lives. And that was to start thinking about, well, what's the underlying genome? I mean, is there something in the genome which might explain this? So I set up a collaboration. It was an international collaboration with other scientists and clinicians from around the world to start looking again at the genes in the human genome to see if there were bits that perhaps were missing, bearing in mind that a lot of the sort of the gene identification had been done for the early part of the human genome using older style techniques. Perhaps if we were to look at new methods and new technologies, we might be able to identify bits that were missing. So that's what we did.
And when was Imogen born?
So she was born in 2012, and 2013 was when she became very, very ill. And she was subsequently she was then diagnosed with very severe cerebral palsy. You know, sadly, she can't even stand, let alone walk. She can speak, unlike my son, who you know, sadly he can't stand or walk, and he doesn't speak at the moment, and he's 3. But it was in 2013 that we set this project up. That big collaboration, really, with, you know, as I say, with people around the world, and actually we published it at the end of last year. These things take a long time. It started off as a small project and sort of blossomed into this really big thing, which was published at the end of last year with lots of different people, and it was that really which made me think about moving more closely to the patient. And of course, I was an academic and I wanted to get much more closely aligned with the patient. So Congenica seemed like a perfect step. And in the meantime, of course, my daughter was enrolled into the 100,000 genomes.
Lots to unpack there. I guess for people who aren't familiar, just explain a little bit about what Congenica does.
So Congenica was originally spun out of a project on the Wellcome Genome Campus called the Deciphering Developmental Disorders Study, which looked at around, I think it's like 14,000 whole exome trios, so mum, dad and child where possible, to look for differences in those DNA sequences to see if you can establish why the child has become poorly. And so essentially Congenica is we have a software platform that allows you to take different sequences, and using clever filtering systems you can get rid of all the sort of the millions of variants that are not causative, to narrow down to look for those which are presumed to be causative. And then that helps a clinician make a decision on whether a variant is likely to be pathogenic or not. Because, of course, we all have, I mean, between me and you, Chris, we probably have sort of 3-4 million different variants to each other. And being able to actually identify which variant is causative is such a huge challenge. It really is. You know, generating genomes isn't actually the bottleneck anymore. It's actually being able to find the causative variant in the genome. So anyway, that's what Congenica does. We provide a software platform that helps clinicians to look for variants that might be causative.
You mentioned that Imogen had been enrolled in the 100,000 Genomes project, which obviously Genomics England was sort of set up initially to do. How did you first as a family become involved in that?
I knew about it and I requested to be involved in it. And actually, I saw, and then to become involved in the participant panel, I saw an advert. Well, actually, someone at work had seen an advert for joining the participant panel and he sent it to me and said, "What do you think of this?" I thought, that's a great idea. And then I had a very long phone call with Vivian Parry about it, which was great. She's I knew instantly from just chatting with her, you know, her enthusiasm is infectious. I knew this is the right thing to be doing. But yeah, obviously I knew about the 100,000 Genomes project. Well, I mean, 100,000 Genomes machines are now on the Genome Campus, aren't they? So
yeah.
Yeah, and it didn't take much for me to convince my wife that it was an interesting thing to do, because she didn't study biology or genomics, but she certainly has an interest in it. So it was quite easy to go forward and do the project.
And so did you go through that as a family, as a trio, as you say, yourself, your wife and Imogen?
Yeah.
At that stage, what were you hoping to gain from the participation?
Well, obviously I wanted to know if there was a reason for Imogen's challenges. But also for family planning, you know, we wanted to have another baby. And if it was, you know, if we could find out if it was a so-called new mutation in Imogen that wasn't in me or my wife, then obviously the chances of it happening again are much smaller than if it's something that Imogen has inherited from me or my wife. And interesting, we know that these sort of new mutations are very much driving force behind a lot of these really nasty neurodevelopmental disorders. You know, the neurodevelopmental disorders are enriched for new mutations. So it seemed like we would, you know, if there was something, we would probably have a reasonable chance of finding it.
You mentioned that Jasper also has cerebral palsy. What did you understand about the risk of that going into, as you said, the second waves of family planning? And if that's something you can explain, sort of how was that different the second time round, or how were you able to deal with what I guess must be a very complex kind of family logistics?
Well, so our clinical geneticist, you know, she said before we were thinking about having another child, she said, let me know if you're going to have, if your wife becomes pregnant, and what I will, you know, we'll have a chat with Mark Caulfield, and we will expedite we will get your genomes prioritized, so we can see if there's, you know, if there's anything in there. And interestingly, true to her word, this was done, and her email popped into my email box 1 minute before Jasper's 12-week scan. Literally 1 minute. I had just enough time to read that we haven't found anything along those sorts of lines. So, you know, that was a relief, I guess, in some respects, that it wasn't, you know, something really, you know, that some of these really terrible disorders that clinicians know about. But of course, it still, you know, it leaves that question as to what happened. So
there's still so much that's unknown, I guess, in terms of the email saying, okay, well, we know that it's not these things, but we're still learning so much, you know, as you are through work and so on about the genome the whole time. And how have you and your wife adapted your life to accommodate Imogen and Jasper's needs?
Well, yeah, so we demolished our garage. We built a downstairs annex for Imogen to live in, which was actually still being built after Jasper had been born. So he was on intensive care for 2 months, and we were given the news after 2 months, just before Christmas. In fact, yesterday was 3 years to the day since we found out about the fact that clinicians discovered he'd suffered catastrophic brain damage during birth, and all that sort of associated horrendousness that went with that Christmas, of course.
Yeah.
And so the house was finished just as he came home. I think it was like the day before he came home, the house was finished. And of course, he was so tiny, we had no idea as to how badly his problems would be. And they, you know, they still can't really tell at that stage. So we developed, you know, we built Imogen's downstairs bathroom and bedroom adapted. We had the ceiling joists are all strengthened with electrics in place to put in hoists if she needs them when she's older. And we also have a minibus, transit minibus, long wheelbase with it's got a lift on the back that gets the wheelchairs in and out, and various other bits and pieces. So now, of course, we've actually run out of room, and we're not quite sure where Jasper's going to go. We'll probably have to put a lift in, and then just see where we go from there. But we have lots of different chairs. We have two manual wheelchairs, two powered wheelchairs. We have special chairs for them for meal times to strap them in. We have standing frames for them to stand in to build up the strength in their leg muscles, because of course they do very little standing. Then we have shower chairs or bathing chairs. We have a couple of special therapy trikes as well that allow them to move their move their legs, which of course they can't do. That's some of it.
Well, that's an extraordinary setup, and you must in your role as a patient advocate hear lots of stories of how different people, I guess, engage with and adapt their lives in these kind of situations. You're obviously coming at this with an incredibly deep background in the science itself. Based on your understanding of what you and others go through and achieve in these circumstances, if you had either a microphone to say something to all of the policymakers and healthcare leadership, or a magic wand, you know, what can quote unquote the system do to make that incredibly full-on situation easier for families like yours?
We have to go through so much bureaucracy. So much bureaucracy. It drives us to tears. It literally drives us to tears. You know, life is so hard as it is at the moment that, you know, dealing with people who just seem to want to make our lives even harder. It's so difficult. It's so difficult. I mean, for example, we had we ordered a bog standard NHS wheelchair, and it just didn't come through. It was months and months of chasing, 6 months, I think it was. And the people who we got it from, we phoned them up and they said, look, again, what? And eventually they came back and said, well, unfortunately, we had two Imogens on the system. An Imogen is such an unusual name that we just thought, you know, we didn't see them as two different people, essentially. And that's what it was, you know, things like that. And then filling in form filling for the things like EHCP and disability living allowance, all that sort of thing. It's,
wow.
I mean, what I would love is if a community paediatrician was able to have a form in front of her when we've been speaking, and she has a little button that says, these people need high rate disability, these people need medium rate, and not for us to have to go through all the rigmarole. It should be as easy as that. And I have actually raised that with various different people who are in those sort of high places. But it really should be, you know, the clinician's word should be taken as sacrosanct, really. And why not? Yeah. Why wouldn't it be? And therefore, they could easily make life that much easier for people like us going through these hard times.
So there's something there about just getting the basics right. And in a former life, I used to do things like work with banks on how you make it easier for someone to get a mortgage or something. This is obviously 100 times more complicated and painful than that as a process. So just getting rid of those barriers to you.
Yeah, I mean, it just, even some of these forms you fill in, they make you live your very worst day. You know, you have to go over the trauma again and again, reliving all these bits that you've tried to forget or tried to get over, and you are. The forms insist that you tell us everything about your worst case scenario, and yeah. All this information is essentially held by the clinician, and it would just make life so much easier if they could do something like that, or just sign a certificate.
Completely, and beyond that process and making it better, you and your wife and Imogen are also participants in effectively a series of research studies. What are your hopes from participation in that collaboration, and what would you say to researchers working on these topics?
Yes, that's a good question. I mean, we probably, there's nothing that's going to be able to be done for my children. My son also had his genome sequenced through fast turnaround study at Cambridge University, and nothing was found there. So it's looking increasingly likely that it was the preterm birth that did all the damage, rather than there being a specific gene expressed in the brain, whatever. But I'm hugely keen to start investigating the reasons behind preterm birth. It's a massively unmet need. I've spoken to clinicians about it, and they say, well, we did look into it, but it's so complex. It's just too big an area to even start doing. So I'm a big fan of doing that, you know, and I would expect, and I don't know, But bearing in mind that I would imagine a lot of participants in the 100,000 genomes may be children, there might be a sort of a proportion of those who are premature. So it would be interesting for me to say to researchers, you know, let's look at preterm birth, you know, see if there's a cohort of preterm children with severe disabilities and see if we can start picking out genetic markers for those sorts of things.
It's really interesting, actually. We have been exploring for a while and talking with various expert groups about the possibilities in newborn whole genome sequencing. And there's been a lot of research into what kind of known conditions that are treatable could you share with the parents at the time of birth. So not saying, oh, your child has a variant that may make it more likely that she has breast cancer when she's older or something like that, which you can't really do anything with as the parents of a newborn child, but saying either we've looked at this list of 200 conditions and your child doesn't have any of those, so that's something, or your child does have one of these 200 conditions that we can do something about, and so therefore we're going to start doing that now. But it's the thought strikes me as we talk that actually within that context, if we're able to put cohorts like that together, actually looking at specifically at preterm births in that context could actually be a really interesting lens on that completely. Looking ahead, you're at Congenica, you've done a huge amount in terms of both representing participants and advocating for their needs. What would you hope to see over the next kind of, I don't know, 3 or 4 years in terms of some movement in these areas?
For the advocacy, I would like genomics to become much more spoken about. I think it's a very trendy subject, really, actually, isn't it? But I would hope that people can begin to see that, you know, genomics can be used for very good purposes. I think that there's still a concern, certainly, and I know this specifically about some patient cohorts, that they're really worried that genomics is going to be used to sort of get rid of certain types of disorders or whatever. I can see why they might think that potentially. But I think it's important for people to realise that, you know, genomics has an enormous potential to make everyone's lives better. You know, from the very beginning, if you find, as you so rightly said, you know, if you have underlying risk factors, you know, you can sort these out before they become a problem. So, yeah, I would hope that just expanding the sort of the interest and understanding of genomics among the general population, you would see a time pretty soon, I imagine, when everyone will have this done. So understanding genomics is a really important thing. From a technological point of view, things like being able to, we go back to talking about Illumina sequencing, of course, using long read sequencing. So Illumina produces these tiny fragments, which means you can produce an enormous amount of sequence very quickly. But what that doesn't help with is if you've got big changes in the genome that you can't see when you align your genome back to the reference, and then the long read sequencing can really help sort of scaffold the genome, and you fill all everything else back in with the short read. And this, you know, seeing that in everyday healthcare would be great. And also sort of beginning to use more of the what we call the omics data. So other than the genome, you know, you want to look at how much a gene is expressed. Is it expressed too much or too little? You know, this might be an indicator that there's a problem, and you can't tell that just with looking at the genome. You can only see if there's a mutation, but you can't then see if that mutation causes the gene to be expressed too much or too little. And then you want to see, well, does that gene actually make, even though it's expressed, that doesn't tell us anything about whether a protein is being made. You know, so you want to then start looking at proteomics and see how much of a protein is being made, and so on. And I think that you can get a lot, there's so much more you can get out of that. And I think marrying all that together is going to be hard. It's going to be very, very hard. But, you know, the human genome was hard 25 years ago, and look where we are now. So,
yeah, and with advances like AlphaFold showing some of the potential of, the bleeding edge of AI in this space. And if we can go back very briefly to this point about engaging with the general public on the topic of genomics and making this case for the positive impact that genomics can have. It's kind of the million-dollar question, but what would you recommend that the whole community does on that front?
Well, I think it's changing now, but I would say that even clinical students, medical students, I don't know how much time they spend reading up on genomics in their study. So I think potentially we even need to sort of look at clinical staff to make sure that they are having a good grounding in genomics. Certainly championing the great things that are coming out of the 100,000 genomes in the press. These things are sort of eye openers, really, aren't they? I don't know how we can get that onto the television more or whatever. But what are we doing now? We're sitting here chatting about genomics, and it's these sorts of things that people will grab people's attention. I would hope.
Absolutely, Charlie. Thanks again, and look forward to catching up soon.
Yes, Chris. Pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.